You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Dostoevsky and the Drama of Ideas That Matter by Shoshana Milgram.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the world of Fyodor Mikhailovich Dostoevsky. Now, Dostoevsky himself is not what anyone would call a morning person. In the universe of Dostoevsky, it is always the dead of night, the end of days, the underground, the dark night of the soul. Okay. And for those of you who remember what happened yesterday when the power went out, I am hoping that nothing like that happens during our lecture, but you never know. In his novels, we do know. The novel's demons, also known as the devils or the possessed, was Ayn Rand's favorite of his works, and it's one of the darkest ones. In part two, there's a chapter called Night, and then the next chapter is called Night Continued. Another chapter refers to morning, but it's a fatal morning. And then in part three, we have a finished romance, The Last Decision, The Last Peregrination of Stepan Trofimovich, and A Toilsome Night. You get the idea. Now, when we read Dostoevsky, we get lots of ideas. He was consumed with ideas. He was consumed by ideas. He lived and breathed and bristled with ideas. Nothing was more important to him in his writing and in his life than ideas. In the novel Demons, he portrays terrible human beings with shocking intimacy, relentless dissection, and frightening insight. But these human beings are not themselves the demons of the title. The actual demons are the ideas that lurk in the shadows of their spirits. Well, that's Dostoevsky for you. Some writers beckon us into a panorama of glory, or a landscape of loveliness, or an avenue extending through limitless possibilities. They welcome us to, at its best, a kind of Garden of Eden, or what the Garden of Eden was supposed to be. Well, if that's what you're seeking in a writer, you need to go shopping in a different store. Because when you read Dostoevsky, you will encounter not a Garden of Eden, but a Garden of Evil. My goal today is to introduce you to the man and to some of his powerful and fascinating writings so that you can use your own eyes and your own minds to encounter what he has to offer. And I'm going to read you now a quotation from another writer, a very different writer, but someone who did appreciate Dostoevsky. It's Virginia Woolf, and this is what she had to say about Dostoevsky. She said, "The novels of Dostoevsky are seething whirlpools, gyrating sandstorms, waterspouts which hiss and boil and suck us in. They are composed purely and wholly of the stuff of the soul. We are drawn in, whirled around, blinded, suffocated, and at the same time filled with a giddy rapture. We open the door and find ourselves in a room full of Russian generals, the tutors of Russian generals, their stepdaughters and cousins, and crowds of miscellaneous people who are talking at the top of their lungs about their most private affairs." Right, that's Dostoevsky. A few warnings before we encounter the whirlpool, or before we walk through the door of Dostoevsky land. First warning. My first warning is to remember that Dostoevsky is an artist. He's not primarily someone who is confessing his own crimes and bearing his own soul. When his characters speak, they may be speaking for him, at least in part, or they may not be speaking for him at all. Thus, it's not fair to Dostoevsky as a man or as an artist to equate him with his characters or to take their statements as definitely expressions of his own ideas. By contrast, in chapter 7 of the third part of Atlas Shrugged, Ayn Rand writes, "This is John Galt speaking." I assume some of you have read this, right? This is John Galt speaking. In that chapter, John Galt is speaking for her. Galt's philosophical statements are indeed the ideas of Ayn Rand. But when Dostoevsky's Dmitri in the Karamazov Brothers says, "If God is dead, then everything is permitted," he may or may not be speaking for Dostoevsky himself. Now, Ayn Rand's characters did not always speak for her. We know this. She's an artist. And so if we remember that she's an artist who also created not just John Galt, but Ellsworth Tui, James Taggart, characters who did not speak for her, then we can recognize that Dostoevsky also is an artist who created such figures as Svidrigailov in Crime and Punishment and Verkhovensky in Demons, without their necessarily speaking for him. So my first warning to you about Dostoevsky is to remember that he's an artist, he's creating, not confessing. Second warning is that even though he is a novelist of ideas, some of those ideas that he actually did believe are dangerous and wrong. He writes with great power. He dramatized principles with passionate intensity and psychological complexity. His plots are built on conflicts of ideas. But you cannot assume that his ideas are true or anywhere near it. He is the dramatist of evil, and many of his characters are motivated by evil ideas, false ideas, some of which the man himself may have shared. So when you read him, you need to observe, to scrutinize, to explore, and to judge the evil of these men and the evil of their ideas. So look sharp, be alert, be vigilant. Ayn Rand, as you may remember, said that reading Dostoevsky was like entering a chamber of horrors, but with a powerful guide, unquote. Now, of course, the powerful guide is Dostoevsky, the writer, but I think there's also the powerful guide you need to activate of your own mind to think about what you're reading. Okay, third warning. A lot of warnings here. And the third warning does follow from the other two. Warning one, as you remember, is he's an artist, not always speaking for himself. Warning two, his ideas are sometimes the opposite of true. Dostoevsky was the poet of evil. Now, for the third, I want to remind you that he did at times aspire to be the poet of the good. He tried. And you should not let it break your heart when he fails to portray the good as being efficacious and triumphant, or when you see what he considers to be the good. So he tried to be the good, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he got there. And I'm thinking of Alyosha Fyodorovich Karamazov, and I'm thinking about what became of Nikolai Vsyevolodovich Stavrogin in Demons. Okay, now that the warnings are over, I have a different kind of warning and to tell you what I can do this morning and what I can't do. Okay, Dostoevsky was a prolific writer. He lived a lot longer than several of his important 19th century contemporaries, such as Pushkin, Lermontov. And those two died in duels, so they really died young. Gogol and Chekhov, I think he may have lived longer than all of them put together. And during his life, he wrote a lot of books, some of them quite long. Dostoevsky had zero interest in the expression, less is more. For him, more was more. So even a quick survey of the highlights, or considering that we're looking at Dostoevsky, the lowlights of his life or of his work could take much more than my allotted time. Okay, that's one kind of warning. I can't possibly tell you about everything. Also, one of the great virtues of his writing is his plot construction. And that's what Ayn Rand talked about, right? His superb mastery of plot structure. But I can't adequately convey his mastery of plot structure without outlining his complex plots, and that would spoil the suspense. And part of the interest in Dostoevsky is that he makes you wait. Okay, you remember what Dickens said, right? Make him laugh, make him cry, make him wait. And Dostoevsky has something in common with Dickens there, and in fact was interested in Dickens. So you have to wait. You have to wait in order to follow the suspense. So I can't tell you about his whole life and work, and I can't really provide the mastery of the plots. So here's what I decided to do. I'm going to share with you three important and powerful passages from his writing, passages that I believe you can appreciate, even though I am ripping them out of the context of the fiction in which they appear. You will also see, I believe, that these passages present some parallels with the writings of Ayn Rand. Okay. Then I'm going to ask you to consider Dostoevsky's ideas and his thinking in relation to two important episodes in his life. Again, so there's a lot of work, I'll give you three passages. There's a lot of life, I'll give you two episodes. And then I'll welcome your questions and conclude with a few words about Dostoevsky and a writer he respected. So here's my first passage. You'll find it in his final novel, The Karamazov Brothers, 1880, and in it, Ivan is speaking to Alyosha, his religious brother, of his craving for a vision of ideal justice, of punishment and reward, of the universal harmony that has been promised to him. And this is what Ivan says. He's concerned with justice, balance. I need retribution, otherwise I will destroy myself. And not somewhere in some time in infinity, but here and now, on earth, so that I see it myself. I have believed, and I want to see for myself. And if I am dead by that time, let them resurrect me, because it will be too unfair if it all takes place without me. Is it possible that I've suffered so that I, together with my evil deeds and sufferings, should be manure for someone's future harmony? I want to see with my own eyes the hind lie down with the lion and the murdered man rise up and embrace his murderer. I want to be there when everyone suddenly finds out what it was all for. Okay? That's from the Brothers Karamazov, translated by Richard Pevere and Larissa Volokhonsky. Well, good for him. He wants understanding. He wants satisfaction. He wants justice on this earth. He wants the ideal in reality. His brother, Alyosha, a believer in religion, anticipates justice, truth, understanding in the world to come. But Ivan doesn't want to wait for the world to come to arrive. He doesn't want to settle for somewhere in some time in infinity. He wants the direct, personal, first-hand experience here and now. Now, Ayn Rand, as an artist, agrees with Ivan that the place for our ideals is here and now on this earth, and not somewhere in some time in infinity. In the foreword to the 1959 edition of We the Living, she writes, "I am a romantic realist, distinguished from the romantic tradition in that the values I deal with pertain to this earth and to the basic problems of this era, here and now." Okay. She looks at the pursuit of values, the adventure of volition, the struggle, the passion, the beauty of splendid human beings, and crafts a story in which these characters and the spirit within them are presented as inhabiting the real world, not separated into a physical or spiritual never-never land. And you're familiar with this from her own writing in many places, including in the description in the first two chapters of part three of Atlas Shrugged of The Valley. Hugh Axton says to Dagny, "Ask yourself whether the dream of heaven and greatness should be left waiting for us in our graves or whether it should be ours here and now and on this earth." A little later, we hear that Dagny is frustrated when she thinks she is doomed to a separation of the ideal from the real. And I'm quoting again, "The final form of the promise that had kept her moving," she thought, "was the man who would perhaps remain a promise never to be reached. He stands for the ideal and is her ideal man. But this," she, Dagny, thought in consternation, "was that view of human destiny which she had most passionately hated and rejected, the view that man was ever to be drawn by some vision of the unattainable shining ahead, doomed ever to aspire but not to achieve. Her life and her values could not bring her to that," she thought. "She'd never found beauty in longing for the impossible and had never found the possible to be beyond her reach. But she had come to it and could find no answer." Later on in the chapter, she hears an answer. Quote, "If you fail, as men have failed in their quest for a vision that should have been possible, yet has remained forever beyond their reach, if, like them, you come to think that one's highest values are not to be attained and one's greatest vision is not to be made real, don't damn this earth as they did. Don't damn existence. Through all those years, that which you most wished to win was waiting for you, waiting as unremittingly as you were fighting, as passionately, as desperately, but with a greater certainty than yours. But in your worst and darkest moments, remember that you've seen another kind of world. Remember that you can reach it whenever you choose to see." Okay. Now, Ivan Karamazov demanded to see the balance here, now, and on this earth. He asked for it. And that's a powerful question, whoever poses it. In Dostoevsky's novel, the person who asks the question is Ivan Karamazov. And Ivan, of course, is a common name. It's the same as the name John, but Karamazov means the black stain of sin. So that's kind of different from what we see in Ayn Rand's writing. Although you could say that the answer to Ivan's question arrived in 1957, you know, some 77 years after he asked the question. So that's my first passage. And maybe it'll make you want to read the Karamazov Brothers. It's a very long book, and that's just a little bit of it, but I think it's very powerful. And it's good, you know. It's about an aspiration for the good. Now I've got a different kind of passage. This one's from Demons, and this is Pyotr Stepanovich Verkhovensky, a villain who is the enemy of all values. And he reveals in a delirious tirade his vision of a world made desolate by nihilism. And here's what he says. I'm selecting, but each belongs to all and all to each. They're all slaves and equal in their slavery. Slander and murder in extreme cases, but above all, equality. First, the level of education, science, and talents is lowered. A high level of science and talents is accessible only to higher abilities. No need for higher abilities, because this man is opposed to knowledge and happiness and property and freedom itself. He says, he's talking to Stavrogin, he says, listen, Stavrogin, to level the mountains is a good idea, not a ridiculous one. No need for education, enough of science. There's sufficient material, even without science, for 1,000 years to come. But obedience must be set up. Only one thing is lacking in the world, obedience. As soon as there is just a tiny bit of family or love, there's a desire for property, and that's trouble. We'll extinguish desire. We'll get drinking, gossip, denunciation going. We'll get unheard of depravity going. We'll stifle every genius in infancy. Everything reduced to a common denominator, complete equality. But there is also a need for convulsion. This will be taken care of by us, the rulers. Slaves must have rulers. Now, Stavrogin is listening to him with chilling attention, and we're told, looking fixedly into his insane eyes. Verkhovensky has insane eyes. Verkhovensky says more things. He admits that his touted socialism is not actually the basis of his essential identity. I'm a crook, really, not a socialist. Ha ha. Listen, I've counted them all up. The teacher who laughs with children at their God and at their cradle is already ours. The lawyer who defends an educated murderer by saying he's more developed than his victims and couldn't help killing to get money is already ours. Schoolboys who kill a peasant just to see how it feels are ours. Jurors who acquit criminals right and left are ours. The prosecutor who trembles in court for fear of being insufficiently liberal is ours, ours. Administrators, writers, oh, a lot of them, an awful lot of them are ours, and they don't know it themselves, unquote. Okay, this is all right there in Dostoevsky. Well, some readers over time have mistakenly believed that Dostoevsky intended to make Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment a hero. Some people have regarded that novel about a self-justifying criminal as if it were a how-to manual. I think it's time to listen up. Verkhovensky states with unmissable clarity that Raskolnikov and his defenders are part of that evil campaign. He's been working subtly and secretly to disrupt and destroy Russia by provoking chaos, destruction, the erosion of values. In this passage, he finally speaks openly of what is on his mind. He lets it all hang out. He admits that he's a destroyer. He boasts that his plan is already succeeding. Knowledge and talents are expendable. Obedience and equality, however, are necessary and all important. And maybe to this crowd, some of this sounds familiar because 63 years later, Ellsworth Toohey similarly lets it all hang out, speaking to Peter Keating in part 4 of The Fountainhead. And Ellsworth Toohey says, kill a man's sense of values, kill his capacity to recognize greatness or to achieve it. Great men can't be ruled. We don't want any great men. Kill by laughter. Laughter is an instrument of human joy. Learn to use it as a weapon of destruction. Turn it into a sneer. It's simple. Tell them to laugh at everything. Or, as Verkhovensky would say, ha ha. Don't allow men to be happy. Happiness is self-contained and self-sufficient. Happy men have no time and no use for you. Happy men are free men. So kill their joy in living. Take away from them whatever is dear or important to them. Never let them have what they want. Make them feel that the mere fact of a personal desire is evil. And then he tells us exactly what he wants. I want power. I want my world of the future. Let all live for all. Let all sacrifice and none profit. Let all suffer and none enjoy. Let progress stop. Let all stagnate. Slavery to slavery, a great circle and a total equality. And as Peter Keating stares at him with the word insane trembling on his lips, Toohey says it first. Insane, afraid to say it, there you sit and the words written all over you, your last hope. Insane, look around you, pick up any newspaper and read the headlines. Isn't it coming? Isn't it here? Every single thing I told you. Well, when we look at Verkhovensky's speech in Demons side by side with Toohey's speech in The Fountainhead, we can see parallels in these confessions and boasts, because they're combinations of confession and boast. Well, the lyrics are more explicitly philosophical in Ayn Rand, but these two men are singing the same evil tune. Many of the implications and strategies are similar. The attack on greatness, the pursuit of equality and obedience, the lust for power, the employment of humor as denigration, and the assertion that the battle is underway and nearly won. So that's my second passage. The third one comes from a short story by the name of Dream of a Ridiculous Man, Smishnova Chilivieka, which is from April 1877, and it was originally published in A Writer's Diary. Okay? And the translation here is from Kenneth Lance. There's an anonymous narrator, the ridiculous man, and he says that he'd realized that the world was empty of purpose and that nothing mattered to him. This passage, the first one we read, appears early in the story when he's explaining his thoughts about suicide, about the meaninglessness of life and of his own life. I suddenly sensed that as far as I was concerned, it wouldn't matter whether the world existed or whether there were nothing anywhere. I began to sense and feel with all my being that nothing existed around me. At first, I kept thinking that a good many things used to exist in the past, but then I concluded that even in the past, there'd not been anything, but that for some reason, it only seemed as if there'd been something. Little by little, I became convinced that there would never be anything in the future either. He purchased a gun and waited for the right moment. He was waiting for the right moment, the moment when he cared. And here's a passage in which the moment came. I resolved that night to kill myself. I'd made such a firm resolution even 2 months before. And despite my poverty, he says, I bought a beautiful revolver and had loaded it the same day. 2 months had passed and it was still lying in my drawer. But so little did it matter to me that I wanted at last to catch a moment when it might matter, even just a little. For what reason, I don't know. And so it was that every night for these 2 months I came home thinking I would shoot myself. I kept waiting for the right moment. Well, this is me now, not the ridiculous man. What I want to call your attention is the state of mind of the narrator, who didn't want to die in a state of indifference. And I think you know where I'm going, because you got my hand out. I'm looking at the opening paragraphs of part 3 of The Fountainhead. Gail Winan raised a gun to his temple. He felt the pressure of a metal ring against his skin and nothing else. He might have been holding a lead pipe or a piece of jewelry. It was just a small circle without significance. I'm going to die, he said aloud, and yawned. He felt no relief, no despair, no fear. The moment of his end would not grant him even the dignity of seriousness. It was an anonymous moment. One must not die like this, he thought. One must feel a great joy or a healthy terror. One must salute one's own end. Let me feel a spasm of dread and I'll pull the trigger. He felt nothing. He shrugged and lowered the gun. He stood tapping it against the palm of his left hand. People always speak of a black death or a red death, he thought. Yours, Gail Winan, will be a gray death. Why hasn't anyone ever said that this is the ultimate horror? Well, what happens afterwards is, of course, different. In Dostoevsky's story, the ridiculous man recovers purpose and comes to believe in his own redemption and the redemption of the world because a child cries. and he realizes that her sorrow matters to him, and that restores meaning to the world. He says, "It seemed clear that from this point, life and the world were dependent upon me, as it were. I can even say that now the world has been created for me alone, as it were. I'll shoot myself, and the world will exist no longer, as far as I'm concerned." And if you want to see where these thoughts lead, you should read the story. Now, Winans' story has within it both redemption and tragedy. Both men wanted their deaths to be meaningful rather than random, and in both cases, there is indeed a kind of justice and no accident, because deaths matter, lives matter, their lives matter, and that's an idea that matters. Okay, well, those were my samples, and I hope that the quotations and the comparisons with works you know, or definitely should know, have enabled you to see that some of Dostoevsky's characters speak openly and powerfully about ideas that matter. But in order to really understand how the ideas fit into the novels and are crucial to the dramatic action, you do need to read the fiction itself and not just little bits. And I will tell you that just as in Ayn Rand's fiction, the passages I read you are embedded in the fiction and that the ideas are related to their actions, so here the statements are themselves kind of previews to the deeds, and the actions are linked with the words, and that the deeds matter. Pyotr Verkhovensky, incidentally, is in fact in the novel a killer with literal and metaphorical blood on his hands. Ideas matter in the fiction of Dostoevsky. They create and they destroy. Now, they did so also in the life of the writer and in the Russia where he struggled and suffered for nearly 60 years. I promised you that I would tell you something about how ideas mattered in his life and in the Russia of his time, but for time, I'm going to limit myself to two episodes in his life. This is a tale of two printing presses. The first one is in the 1840s. Dostoevsky's in his 20s. He's living in St. Petersburg. He was educated as a military engineer, but he's not interested in engineering, and he's not interested in the military. He wants to be a writer. He had great popular and critical success with the short work Poor Folk. The famous critic Bielinski said that Dostoevsky was, in effect, the new Gogol, and he really admired Gogol, and he thought that Dostoevsky was the defender of the oppressed and the downtrodden, and deserved to be mentioned in the same breath with the well-known and respected, at that time, writer Gogol. Then, Dostoevsky's next book was very different from his first in both style and content, and Bielinski, the big critic, disapproved and said so. So after that, Dostoevsky was no longer Petersburg's boy wonder, but he wanted to write what he wanted to write, and in his own voice, continued living in the city, still hoping to succeed as a writer. And he did not close the door to Bielinski. He remained in contact with Bielinski, and he understood and agreed with many of his ideas. One of these was that Bielinski was opposed to the church as an institution and also to religion as a smokescreen for the mistreatment of the serfs. He was, in fact, Bielinski, a proponent of atheism. You know, thought that religion was bad for the soul, and in his 20s, Dostoevsky was learning atheism from him. During this time, around 1847, Dostoevsky joined a discussion group known as the Petrushevsky Circle, which read and explored Western language, literature, and culture, including books that Tsar Nikolai had forbidden. Well, they didn't all agree. They weren't that kind of group. There was no uniformity or consistency, but they were all against serfdom, they were all against the Tsar, and they all wanted Russia to be more similar to the West. As you can imagine, attending meetings of this circle could be hazardous to one's health, and some of the people were doing more than attending meetings. He'd also made a commitment to political activism. He joined a secret society led by Spieshnev, who was also a member of the Petrushevsky Circle, so there was overlap. But the plan of this circle was to set up a printing press in order to publish anti-serfdom propaganda and to ignite a kind of peasant revolution. Well, what happened next? Bielinski, the critic, right, wrote an inflammatory document. He had turned against Gogol in 1847 after reading Gogol's latest, selected passages from correspondence with friends, he'd written an open letter, really open, to Gogol. And he said that Gogol was a renegade. He was a traitor, that Gogol had endorsed the church. And this meant working hand in hand with the Tsar to crush the very people Bielinski had praised Gogol for supporting. And I'm going to read you an excerpt from a translation of Bielinski's open letter. "One cannot keep silent when lies and immorality are preached as truth and virtue. You, Gogol, fail to realize that Russia sees her salvation not in mysticism or asceticism or pietism, but in the successes of civilization, enlightenment, and humanity. What she needs is not sermons, she's heard enough of them, or prayers, she's repeated them too often, but the awakening in the people of a sense of their human dignity lost for so many centuries. She needs rights and laws, conforming not to the preaching of the church, but to common sense and justice. Instead of which, she, Russia, presents the dire spectacle of a country where men traffic in men." Still reading from Bielinski. "Such are the problems that prey on the mind of Russia in her apathetic slumber. And at such a time, a great writer, whose astonishingly artistic and deeply truthful works have so powerfully contributed toward Russia's awareness of herself, enabling her to take a look at herself as though in a mirror, publishes a book in which he teaches the barbarian landowner to make still greater profits out of the peasants and to abuse them still more in the name of Christ and the church. And would you expect me not to become indignant? Why, if you had made an attempt on my life, I could not have hated you more than I do for these disgraceful lines." That's telling him, right? If he doesn't know, now he knows. So that's Bielinski's open letter to Gogol about his ideas and the evil of those ideas. Now, the reason I wanted to read this letter to you is that I'm allowed to do it, okay? Reading that very letter is what got Dostoevsky into trouble, okay? He read it aloud in public. And other members of the circle printed it up and distributed it publicly. Whatever their disagreements, they agreed with this letter. They were on common ground. And pretty soon, the Tsar made it clear what ground he thought that ought to be. 60 men, people who read Bielinski's open letter aloud, those who published it, and those who failed to report on those who did these things, were arrested and sent to the Peter and Paul fortress. It was a prison. In 1924, after the Bolshevik Revolution, it became, you know, some years after, it became a tourist attraction. And as a teenager, Elisa Rosenbaum, Ayn Rand, was a tour guide there. So she was a tour guide in the prison where he was locked up at this time. Well, what happened? Some of those who were arrested were released. 15 of them were sentenced to death. On December 22, 1849, the 15 prisoners were transported to Semyonovsky Square. There was snow on the ground. There was a scaffold in the middle of the square with three stakes near it. The prisoners were divided into groups of three. The first group included Petrushevsky, the leader. And the death sentence was read to all the prisoners, and they were given white peasant blouses and nightcaps and helped into these articles of clothing, which were supposed to be their funeral shrouds. Okay? The priest called upon them to repent. Most of them did not repent, although it's said that they all did kiss the cross when it came by. One prisoner afterwards remembered that Dostoevsky had been thinking of Victor Hugo, had been quoting from Le dernier jour d'un condamné à mort, the last day of a condemned man. And he said that Dostoevsky had walked up to Spieshnev and said, "Nous serons avec le Christ," we will be with Christ, which means that in some extent, at that point, he was thinking of Christ. And Spieshnev said, "Un peu de poussière," a little bit of dust. He wasn't going for that. Just saying. Now, the first three were led from the scaffold and tied to three stakes. They were ordered to pull their caps down over their heads, okay, to not see. And Petrushevsky pulled his cap back up, and looked straight at the guns. Dostoevsky was in the next group of three, waiting. Then the drums rolled. When Dostoevsky heard the drums, he was an ex-military man, and he knew that that means retreat, and he knew that he would live. The official pardon arrived by horse, and the executions had been canceled on account of reported judicial error. Now, the Tsar had intended to pardon them, but he intended for the good news to arrive after the prisoners had experienced the fear of imminent death. One of the men in that first group of three lost his reason and never recovered. No one died that day, but understandably, no one forgot that day. It shows up in Dostoevsky's writing and, of course, in his mind. He never forgot that he'd believed himself to be within minutes of death, sentenced to death because of a letter that had been printed and read aloud, and because of the printing press he'd agreed to support. In the novel The Idiot, he wrote about the feeling of that experience, you know, not the whole background, but of being within minutes of death. But that day, when he got back to his cell, he wrote a letter to his brother telling him the whole story and hoping in the years of exile and hard labor in Siberia, because he wasn't walking free, he was still going to be exiled and sent to Siberia, but he hoped that he would still be able to write, because for him, he said, not being able to write would be worse than death. But he felt able to write now. He said he felt full of energy. He said he hoped for health. He was singing in his cell. He wrote to his brother, quote, "They will poison me, true, but I still have my heart and the same flesh and blood, and these two can live, suffer, desire, and remember, and that, after all, is also life. On voit le soleil." There he goes, quoting Victor Hugo again, you know, "When sees the sun." Okay. He didn't return to Petersburg until 1859, 10 years later. And when, well, you know, we have information about the years that he was away, but I'm not going to give you all of that now. He wrote his Notes from the House of the Dead, etc. But he did return 10 years later. Who was he? What had he learned? How had he changed? Did he agree with Bielinski that the church was the tool of oppression? Or did he advocate a religion of love that was consistent with Christianity? What did he think about God? Was he a revolutionary? Was he an anti-revolutionary? Was he a man of the West? Was he a devoted Slavophile? Was he angry with his former cause, his former friends, his former self? Well, I'd like to be able to answer those questions, but obviously I'm going to leave them as questions without firm answers. I would love to ask him what he actually believed and to ask him follow-ups. I'd like to know for sure. What I can say is that those important questions were at the center of his soul, and he kept working through them, but he already knew that saying his answers out loud, you know, that's a return trip to Siberia or who knows what. And there was censorship, of course, at the time, real censorship, and which he indeed encountered even when there was some self-censorship, so he wasn't going to be able to speak the whole truth or to put into words everything he wanted to say. So now we're going to go another 10 years forward, 1869. He'd been wrestling with the question of religion. He had in mind a major project, a novel or a series of novels of ideas. And the title was going to be Life of a Great Sinner, and the alternative title was Atheism. And in this novel, the hero was going to be a man who encountered both debauchery and asceticism, who confronts orthodoxy and atheism, Slavophiles and Westernizers, Christ and Antichrist, Russia and Europe. It was to be the saga of a spiritual pilgrimage through evil, suffering, and self-denial to saintliness. And he said, "This novel is my entire hope and the entire expectation of my life." You know, this was a novel he was very committed to writing. But at the same time, he was also dealing with current events. So the largest possible universal issues, and also he's following current events. At this time, he came upon another tale of a printing press, which he learned about when he had a visit in Dresden from his brother-in-law. And I'm going to quote from Richard Pevere, one of my translators, about a true story that Dostoevsky's brother-in-law, who was a student at the Petrov Agricultural Academy, told him in the fall of 1869. And I'm quoting now from Pevere's summary. In the course of their conversations, his brother-in-law told him about a fellow student at the academy by the name of Ivan Ivanov, a man of intelligence and strong character who had radically changed his convictions. In other words, a man who had the courage to change his mind. The figure appealed to Dostoevsky, and he thought of writing a novel about the revolutionary movement of the time with Ivanov as one of the main heroes. On November 21, 1869, this same Ivanov was murdered in the park of the Petrov Academy by a group consisting of two students, an older writer, and their leader, a hanger-on in university circles with credentials from the anarchist movement abroad, the 22-year-old nihilist Sergei Nechayev. Ivanov had protested against Nechayev's dictatorial rule over their group and had eventually left the society. It was thought he might turn informer, but, you know, you couldn't just leave the society. Lured to an artificial grotto near the pond in Academy Park on the pretext of helping to recover a printing press hidden there, Ivanov was thrown to the ground, beaten, strangled, and finally shot in the head by Nechayev. The body, weighted with bricks prepared beforehand, was shoved through a hole in the ice, close quote. So that's something that happened and that he learned about and that was current events at the same time that he was thinking about writing of these issues. So the new novel was in part inspired by Ivanov's repudiation of the ideas of Sergei Nechayev and the fact that quitting Nechayev is not easy to do. But he also had in mind the story of the great sinner, the adventurer who confronts all the movements of his time. Over a period of years, as he planned and wrote the novel, he brought together this horror story of a violent attack and the philosophical story of a spiritual journey and integrated them. Now, you've already met his version of Nechayev the killer, that character, Pyotr Verkhovensky, whose Tui-like tirade I read to you, is a stand-in for Nechayev. The great sinner is a character known as Stavrogin, and you'll meet him if you read the novel. For today, I'm just going to whet your appetite by reading you what Ayn Rand had to say about Stavrogin in What is Romanticism, and I'm quoting now. It is significant that according to Dostoevsky's preliminary notes for The Possessed, his original intention was to create Stavrogin as an ideal man, an embodiment of the Russian Christian altruist soul. As the notes progressed, that intention changed gradually in logically inexorable steps dictated by Dostoevsky's artistic integrity. In the final result, in the actual novel, Stavrogin is one of Dostoevsky's most repulsively evil characters. That's what she had to say. So, whom do you still need to meet? Well, the stand-in for Ivan Ivanov is a character by the name of Ivan Pavlovich Shatov, whose ideas, as expressed in the novel, are a rejection of the nihilists and so an embrace of the Russian God as the expression of the Russian soul and as the principle and foundation of the ability to discern good and evil. Some people say that Shatov was speaking for Dostoevsky. Maybe that's true. Shatov tells Stavrogin he rejects him. He rejects not just Nechayev, but Stavrogin. You've lost the distinction between evil and good because you've ceased to recognize your own nation. Shatov insists that Stavrogin explain what he actually thinks. He says, nothing is more important than that explanation. We are two beings, and we've come together in infinity. For the last time in the world, abandon your tone and take a human one. At least for once in your life, speak in a human voice, not for my sake, but for your own. Don't you want to know what he says? Right? Shatov, who is struggling to define his own convictions and to stand by them, remembers that he once listened to Stavrogin, as Dostoevsky had listened to Belinsky, for example. He remembers Shatov, a time when he was persuaded by Stavrogin, yet came to realize that Stavrogin himself did not have a principled consistency, much as Belinsky came to repudiate Gogol because he thought he wasn't consistent. So, you know, aspects of his engagement with ideas in his own life, there are some parallels in the fiction. So, what's going to happen here? What will Stavrogin say? How will Shatov react? What will happen when Shatov makes his own choice and determination? Now, the readers of the novel knew what had happened to the historical figure Ivan Ivanov, and, you know, they recognized that. They knew what was waiting for a man who walked away from a Nechayev. We readers, if we remember the history, know what can happen to a man who reconsiders everything he thought and learned and then decided that he had a mind and could change it. Readers can weigh what it means for a man seeking and searching and yearning for understanding to take a good look at a mentor or a friend or a comrade and to judge that man. I will add, by the way, for those who haven't read the novel, that the plot thickens because Stavrogin is also a romantic rival to Shatov. He's the man with whom Shatov's wife ran away. Okay, so is it possible in fiction or in fact to escape from demonic possession? And what, after all, were those demons? Now, Richard Pevere, the translator, writes that demons are, quote, ideas, that legion of isms that came to Russia from the West. Idealism, rationalism, empiricism, materialism, utilitarianism, positivism, socialism, anarchism, nihilism, and underlying them all, atheism, to which the Slavophiles opposed their notions of the Russian earth, the Russian God, the Russian Christ, the light from the East, and so on. Well, there's a battle there. It might not be the terms in which, in objectivism, we would describe it, but that's who they are. That's what they're discussing, the people in the book. So when you read Dostoevsky, you'll see that ideas matter. Shatov's ideas matter. Verkhovensky's ideas matter. Ivan Karamazov's ideas matter. Welcome to the world according to Dostoevsky. So for today, I chose to give you some passages and some episodes rather than to tell you everything you might want to know about Dostoevsky. If I had more time, I'd spend time with another of his late and great short works. It's a story called A Gentle Creature, which I like quite a bit. And if you read it, you might see if anything in it reminds you of anything in Ayn Rand. And while we're working on our memories, if the name Ivan Ivanov, the real-life victim of the real-life Nechayev, if that sounds familiar to you, of course it's a common name, you know, Johnson, John Johnson, it could be because it's a common-sounding name, or it could be because Ayn Rand gave that name to the man in the final chapter of We the Living, who was guarding the border of the Soviet Union. Ivan Ivanov is there too. Well, as usual, I have more things to tell you about my subject, and I do have some last words, but before then, I wanted to give voice to you and to let you ask me questions before I conclude. So, time now for questions. Thank you.
Shoshana, my question is about the brothers Karamazov, and for my concrete, I want to use a certain 2 minutes of the film version, specifically Maria Schell's dance scene, a scene of self-confident joy, which is free of guilt. And I think it's, if any man over the age of 12 has seen that film, that scene would be burned into their memory. To what extent is that Dostoevsky?
Okay, all right, you're asking a question about the movie, and it's been a long time since I've seen that movie, so it's not vivid in my mind. I know that Maria Schell was a talented performer. When Maximilian Schell won his Oscar, the headlines in the German newspapers said, Maria Schell's brother wins Oscar, you know? That's how it was. Was she playing Grushenka? Okay, all right, well, some of you know this already, I'm sure. There was another performer who wanted to play the part of Grushenka and did not get the chance to do it. It was Marilyn Monroe. Okay, she read The Brothers, and she thought that was a good part for her. And you know those idiots, you know, the reporters interviewing her and so on, they said, can you spell Grushenka? And, you know, stupid things. But, you know, she'd read that, and she thought that was a good part for her. So I guess if we're going to think of Marilyn Monroe as a kind of critic here, if Marilyn Monroe thought that was a good part for her, then I can, you know, and she certainly expressed joy, I can imagine that being, maybe Maria Schell could be something like Marilyn in that, but I don't have a vivid memory myself of seeing it. I love Marilyn Monroe, by the way, and I think what Ayn Rand said about her, you know, very, very poignant, very accurate, and she certainly was mistreated at the time, and you know, so she had a quick wit, and I think she really did read the book, and she thought that was a good part for her. They asked her, you know, Marilyn, is it true that you want to play the brothers Karamazov? And she said, no, 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 I don't want to play the brothers. I want to play Grushenka. She's a girl. Okay, yeah, she is. You know, that is a powerful, life-loving character, and she almost even threatens to take over the book. Grushenka. So I'll have to see the movie again and see, but I don't remember.
There is a clip of a 2-minute clip of the dance scene itself on YouTube.
Okay. All right. Maybe you'll show me later. Is that what? I don't think we can kind of show it here. Okay. But you'll show it later, and maybe we can look on YouTube. Okay. Thank you.
Hi from Europe. Good morning. So there's a question, Shoshana. It's about the book The Possessed, which is another title for the demons. And the question from our friend is, was Dostoevsky's main objection to the possessed that they were possessed or that they were possessed with the wrong ideas? Was Dostoevsky against strong ideologies as such, or only was he against bad ideologies?
Okay. Well, I think that the proper title is Demons, Bjesi, which means the demons themselves, the ideas. And I don't think that all the characters are demons, but the passage that Dostoevsky includes in the front of the book, and then it also appears in the book itself, it's a biblical passage, and it's about human beings being possessed by demons, so it's together, and then the demons are released. Okay, and so I think that the issue isn't that people are taken over by ideas, but what the ideas are. You could say that there are certain kinds of ideas that people, if they were using their minds, wouldn't accept regardless, wouldn't embrace regardless, and so there's some element of blaming the people, which you can. You know, people who accept, grown-ups, you know, who embrace bad ideas ought to do better. And I think Dostoevsky did believe in that. He didn't think that ideas were, had power over people that they could not resist. That's why he was interested in writing a book to begin with about someone who considered various ideas and changed his mind. And in fact, Shatov is a key example within the surviving book of someone who changes his mind. Of course, you know, dark view of things, look what happens to him. So, you know, it's the ideas. And as far as there being different titles, demons is more literal, so that's why I like it. The devils is okay too, except, you know, in Russian we don't have a definite article, so demons captures it very well. And the possessed means referring to the biblical passage about the demonic possession, so I think that's less good. Yes?
I wonder if you could talk about who in the Brothers Karamazov speaks for Dostoevsky and why.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting question. Who within the brothers speaks for Dostoevsky, and why do I think so? I think, in fact, at different moments, different characters speak for him. I think that question that is asked about, you know, I want justice now, he believes in that because it's very, very powerful to him. And the character even says, if I knew that all the happiness of the world depended on the suffering of a child, that's not for me. I return my ticket, he says. You know, and I think that's a spirit Dostoevsky would go with. I think that Alyosha is the religious character, and Dostoevsky had some elements of religion, but Alyosha's weak. And Alyosha also reconsiders his thoughts, and he's not efficacious. And then there's Dmitri, okay? And Dmitri is someone who is impulsive, and yet near the end of the book, he has a dream. And he awakens from that dream and, you know, discovers a certain sense of purpose in life. So I think that the three of them count for something. But Dostoevsky also, well, there are a lot of characters in the book. There are children in the book. And I think even giving the book the title of The Brothers Karamazov emphasizes that even among these disparate characters, and I didn't even mention Smerdyakov, who... Well, I'm not going to invite what they call the Viennese delegation. You know, I'm not going to bring Freud into the story, but some people would. Dostoevsky's own relationship with his father. Just saying. If you're interested in that, you can pursue that. And I think there's probably something to it. You know, that he had a troubled relationship with his father, and so the notion of the four brothers who each have some reason for resenting the father, there's something of Dostoevsky in that. But the whole book, it's not as if there's sort of one place where the light shines and says, okay, this is, you can color code it, this is what he thinks. I don't think that's the case, but if you think there is and can find it, and you know, you're welcome to show it to me.
Thank you, Shoshana.
Thank you. Okay, I got another question here.
Hi. So I teach high school literature, and I often think about incorporating Dostoevsky. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts as to which novels you would, or which novel you'd go for first?
Okay, quick question about teaching Dostoevsky in high school. I think that based on what I've observed, a lot of people teach Crime and Punishment. I don't think it's necessarily taught that well. I score the AP English exam, and many students come into that and choose to write on Crime and Punishment and seem to have the idea, well, you know, he was a student with good intentions. Well, those high school students, they're students with good intentions, and I don't want to see them turning out like Raskolnikov. I actually think that the shorter works can be more teachable because they might actually read them and not, you know, make do with summaries. So the brothers, if you wanted to teach that for a whole semester, mm-hmm. you could do that because there are different points of view, but that would take a whole year, I think, to do properly. I've taught it once, and it kind of became the book that ate the course. You know, it was a very, very long book for us to read. Demons, on the other hand, if you have enough time, it's very I find it to be very interesting. It's Ayn Rand's favorite. Notes from Underground is one that some people like to teach because it's relatively short. I think that that's better for older students because, well, it got censored. And we've not recovered everything that was taken out. And, well, that's sort of not something you want to explain to students about you're not reading the whole thing. But I think, you know, young students, but I think an older person could, we do the best we have with the fragment that we have. And I mean, it's very interesting, but I think that's especially one in which Dostoevsky is kind of doing a loop of giving a character who is disagreeing with ideas of Chernyshevsky that Dostoevsky had at one time had some sympathy with and then firmly rejected. So you kind of have to do a loop if you're going to teach Notes from Underground. Although, you know, it is shorter, and if you have smart students and who are capable of not just absorbing all of this as, well, that's what Dostoevsky thinks, then that would be a good choice, too. I happen to think Dream of a Ridiculous Man is very interesting. It's not that long. I like White Nights. I think White Nights is romantic and quite striking, and that also is not too long. And I don't think there's an enormous amount. I generally like, when there are works that the students are going to read for themselves, that's a big advantage over works for which they're going to run to the summary, and then they get it second, third, fourth hand. So that I guess that's what I'd say. Again, if you've got a small class and you can make sure they're actually reading the reading, that would be great. So that's what I think.
Thank you for your talk. I was wondering if in The Brothers, you might say that the totality of the theme is captured in the scene with the horse.
Well, that's a big question, and I'll just say briefly that Dostoevsky likes a lot of horses. There's a horse scene, there's a dream, right, in Crime and Punishment, and it all comes both from a poem that he read and also from some experience that he had. So, you know, the notion there of... I'm not going to do an Ocon talk on horses, but I'm just saying, though, but, you know, there's sort of a horse thing in Anna Karenina, right? Remember when the horse has to be shot, and it's like shooting Anna, and Tolstoy did Holstomir, which is kind of an autobiography of a horse. So I don't know if I would go so far as to say that, except to say that, yeah, you should pay attention to that. And I think also pay attention to the dream in Crime and Punishment. I think I'm a couple minutes from the end, and I did want to sort of give you some last words that aren't trailing off, right? A couple minutes from the end, is that right? Or am I, I hope I'm not over it. Well, in brief, I want to say something about Dostoevsky and Victor Hugo, whom you all, I hope, know, and or know to some extent, because there is a contrast between them as well as the connections. To make a long story short, which of course Dostoevsky and Hugo hardly ever did, What we have is Dostoevsky having great admiration for Hugo. I already told you, he quotes him as he's just about dying. He translated him. He was begging, borrowing, and stealing a copy of Les Miserables when he's writing Crime and Punishment. He says, just give it to me. Even if you can't give me the whole thing, give me a little bit. He was delighted when he took it on his first honeymoon with his second wife, took that novel along with him. When he was briefly in prison, not the Siberia time, but another time, he said, oh, good, finally I have time enough to read. You know, good chance to read. So true story. So he really loved the novel, and yet there are big differences. And I could talk about some of the parallels and foils with the plot, which maybe you can think of for yourself. But what I wanted to end with today is the important contrast that in Les Miserables, thinking saves your life, okay? That there's the great scene, the tempest in a skull of Jean Valjean figuring out what he needs to do, asking the right questions, and deciding and acting accordingly. He deliberates. He considers. He asks the right questions. And then, you know, he knows what to do. He thinks. In Dostoevsky's world, thinking is trouble. Okay, people who think and talk about their thoughts, explicit ideas, it can be a sign of trouble. And in fact, in Crime and Punishment, there's a nightmare that Raskolnikov has near the end, and it's in the epilogue, in which he has a dream of humanity afflicted by a plague, and the plague is too much thinking. Okay? They think that their scientific conclusions and moral convictions are infallible. And what do? In his dream? They kill each other. They eat each other. And the protagonist, in the end of Crime and Punishment, is redeemed only by abandoning thinking itself, surrendering himself to Sonya's religion, to emotions. Okay, now, Dostoevsky knew that emotions and faith are not the only alternative to bad ideas, and he knew that not all people who express ideas are as poisonous as Verkhovensky. And we recognize, as we listen to the ideas of Raskolnikov and the ideas of Verkhovensky, that their distorted ideas have led to distorted lives. But implicitly, we can think that the road to a better life is paved with sounder ideas. And we, unlike Dostoevsky, have a better idea of where to look for better ideas. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.